What is up, Z-Pack? It's your boy, Z-Dog MD, and we are live and direct with Against Medical Advice in the middle of the week. Why did we make an exception to our normal rule of doing Against Medical Advice, our deep dive looking at thought leaders and people who are going up against the grain in medicine to transform it? We did it in the week because my boy, Dr. Robert Groves, is here, and this guy is off the proverbial chain, all right? He is a baby boomer, which makes him dope already, okay, and incredibly narcissistic. Here's the story. Pulmonary critical care doctor, was in private practice in Colorado for a long time, then moved to Arizona, where he brought to Banner Health a series of technologies as well as tremendous leadership across the sort of spectrum of care for many years, and now has recently transitioned to a brave new 3.0 world as the executive vice president and chief medical officer for the new joint Banner Aetna thing, which we're going to talk about. And you heard the word Aetna, and I know y'all Z-Pack are like, oh, just wait. Oh, just wait. It gets real. Dr. Robert Groves.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That was a great introduction.
You know, no formal training.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm so excited to be here. I am so excited to be here. But the docs back home, they're really excited. The younger docs, they know who you are.
What?
They know what this is about, and they're excited. They want selfies. They want all this stuff.
Robert, they will get none of those things. Do you know why? Because they don't deserve it. They don't deserve it because they didn't come to Vegas on their own volition to come to talk to us. And the reason, and I know why you're doing this, because you and I have met before.
Yep.
When I was doing a talk in Phoenix and you were doing a talk. And we were both speaking for Aetna.
And yes, we were.
I learned at that point that, wow, a large insurance company is actually doing tremendously innovative 3.0 things.
Yeah.
And you were a part of it. And you went and spoke and before I did. And I watched you and I was like this, oh my God, I have such a man crush right now. Oh my God. Because everything Robert said was spot on to how we're thinking and talking about growing from health 1.0, which you were raised in, through 2.0, which is our mechanized hellscape, to 3.0, which is this repersonalized, outcomes-driven, less is more, connected, compassionate, collaborative care. And when I saw you speak, I was like, holy crap. And then you saw me speak and you didn't hate it either.
I loved what you had to say. And when you talked about turntable health, it was like, that's exactly what should be happening. That's the way we ought to be delivering care. So yeah, we got a bromance going on.
Z-Pack, listen to me carefully. This is what happens when doctors have a bromance. They're like, oh my gosh, this talk was so dope, Tom. You can't even believe it. Like, it was dope. And then we started exchanging ideas afterwards, and I realized, wow, like, you are years ahead of any experience I've had in healthcare systems transformation. I wanted to learn from you, and the more I talked to you, I realized not only are you this tremendous human being, you're a tremendous storyteller, so you motivate and you lead through telling stories, which to me is how humans learn. It's how we grow. We're story-based. And so I fell in love with it, and I wanted to bring you on the show so you could share what you shared with me, some of it, but I want to learn more from you and have the Z-Pack be a part of it. Are you in?
I am totally in.
That's awesome.
Anything's on the table. I'll
okay.
Put it that way.
Tell me about your childhood, Robert, because I'm telling you, like, you and I share this common thread, which is the parents, the dad who is the doctor.
Yep,
your
absolutely.
Dad was in Georgia.
Yeah, I grew up in Southwest Georgia, Albany, Georgia. And my dad was a primary care doc. He, at the time, they called them general practitioners because there was no such thing as family practice. And so, that was my exposure to medicine. I remember rounding with him, for example.
Wait, you rounded? How old were you when you rounded with him? Because my dad would never let me round with him until I was in medical school.
Yeah. No, I was probably 7, 8 when I first started making rounds with him. And
What a gunner.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
And we used to go into the physician's lounge, and morning report still happened. I mean, this is private practice, but they still did morning report.
In private practice.
Every morning, everybody would go into the cafeteria in this big room, and they'd talk about the cases that came in the night before. Specialists and primary care docs sitting down together at the table. Now, the tables all had built-in ashtrays at the time,
and it was the South, so of course, tobacco is king.
Exactly, yeah. But it was fascinating, and I guess what drew me to it is my dad was one of the first doc in Albany, Georgia, that had a mixed waiting room. This is, you know, this is a while back.
You mean an integrated, racially integrated
waiting room? Exactly.
Wow.
So that there was no, you know, there wasn't a black side and a white side, or a black restroom and a white restroom. He pulled it all together. And so he declared himself in
right,
a way
for who
in
he
that
was
community,
right
for yeah. who he was. It was a great lesson for us as kids. But what happened was he developed some really close relationships with the folks that he took care of. Yeah. And he, you know, he got paid not in dollars sometimes, you know, and
chickens.
Chickens. Yep. And the house that I ended up growing up in actually was a gift from a patient of his.
Wow.
And so that kind of connection and relationship was just so intriguing to me. And that's what got me started on this track of, I want to be like that too.
It's the same thing with me. Seeing my dad, and the patients would give him these gifts, and you know, they almost always caused diarrhea, like almost 90% of the time, because they were pretty, you know, they were well made, but not for weak stomachs. And I remember thinking, God, the kind of loyalty and connection that it took, and he loved them. And I think that's why he still practiced. He can't give up that piece of it. So that's 1.0. That's our parents'
yeah,
medicine.
Yeah.
Now, when you trained, your dad gave you some advice, right? He gave me the same advice my dad gave me.
It's the same thing. Because I loved what he did. And medicine was already starting to change by the time that I got into training. And so, but it wasn't all that clear to me. It was clear to him, obviously, since he was immersed in it. And he advised me to get a specialty. because you need to be able to do something.
Do something with your hands.
You get paid for doing things.
That's
you don't
what my
get
dad
paid
said.
For thinking.
That's
and,
what he said
yeah.
the same exact thing.
And that's how I wound up actually going into pulmonary medicine. So I figured, you know, all else fails, I've got the bronchoscope. And,
right, right.
And so from the start, there was this shift in my thinking from, hey, wait a minute, you know, I thought it was about this connection and this relationship. And all of a sudden, you start to get drawn in to the context of the business of medicine.
Well, when do you think you first realized that the business of medicine and the reality of medicine was discordant with what you were sort of assuming it would be based on your dad's practice?
Yeah, you know, I think I could sublimate that through most of my training.
Mm.
Because, you know, we're underpaid, overworked, which feels perfect. You know, I mean, this is sacrifice. This is what I thought
yeah.
it would be
altruism,
like.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that was, it was easy to not think about it then. Mm. But when I got into practice, I remember, you know, and I loved my patients. I spent too much time with them. My notes were too long, all of that stuff. And by this time, I'd also done critical care. And so I got exposed to the emotional rawness and the intimacy of death and dying, you know, and how to be there for patients and their families when this really tough stuff was going on. But on the other side, I found myself having conversations about, yeah, you know, if we own the pulmonary function test equipment, we can bill, two charges instead of one. And it's so incongruous. It was so difficult to make those two things line up. But that's, you know, it's very seductive, and
yeah.
slowly we get drawn into it, and we tend to end up practicing like and doing things like those that are around us, particularly when we're young and impressionable.
Always the case. The context that we're around influences our practice so much. That's why I always say, you know, if you don't have good mentors, if you're not around people that you think have a lot of integrity, just watch, because your unconscious elephant's going to start getting conditioned in a way that you're just going to instinctively do these things.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. And you can be so far down that road before you shake your head and wake up and say, hey, what just happened?
It can be years.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
for me, I remember I fell deep into that, into the billing, the 99239, discharge level 3, 35 minutes, and then the end of life stuff. So here you are, you're incentivized to do things to people, not for people, yeah. in a fee-for-service, volume-based thing. So the Medicare patient that's there, it's much more lucrative to keep them in the ICU than to have the tough, painful, difficult conversation about when are we torturing this person?
Yeah.
What were their wishes? What are your wishes at age 25 if something happens? Those kind of things. So how did you handle end of life as a pulmonary critical care? You know, I saw so many ICU attendings who got it wrong, and then I saw a few that were role models to me that
yeah,
got it right.
Yeah. It, you know, it's a delicate balance because... And I'll say it this way, families don't want to feel like I made the decision to take dad off of life support. Mm. And so what I try to do is create the context for that conversation about, you know, I start out with, you know, has mom or dad or your brother ever talked about, you know, what their wishes were for the end of life, or what kind of person were they, and establish and kind of get that established first, and can learn a lot by just asking those sorts of questions about what kind of person was this. And then I think you take the conversation to, what do you think if they were able to look, somehow just look down on us right now? What do you think they would be thinking about this situation? And I try to paint for them a picture that has a reasonable amount of uncertainty, because there's always uncertainty. Huh. You know, there's always uncertainty about what could happen. Could a miracle happen? Yes, but if it does, they probably don't, you know, God or doesn't need me, whoever that is, or whatever you believe, wouldn't need me for a miracle. And so, you know, putting it in that context so that they're once removed from it. And I even sometimes, depending on what it feels like in the conversation, explicitly say, I'm not asking you to decide. I'm asking you, what do you think they would have wanted if they were in your shoes right now? And that changes the whole conversation.
You've absolved them in some way from the direct responsibility for the decision.
Yeah, that's what scares people.
Right, it really is. They don't want to be the one to make. And there's all the inter-family dynamics, right?
So, yes.
You know, Aunt Maud is three states away. She has guilt because she hasn't been the one taking care of dad. Daughter there has been taking care of dad. She really wants him to be comfortable, knows him, doesn't want this, but is worried, and this person is part of the decision tree.
And as you know, it's usually the family that is most distant and feels most guilty about being distant that is
pushes back, always. Mm-hmm. And we did a whole song on that and got a lot of stories. The way to die. Yeah. And we had a lot of stories about how, yes, that's exactly how it plays out. So you were in the midst of that in a career in private practice for some time. And then on the technology side. So what were you doing on the tech side?
Yeah, that was interesting. I've always been fascinated by the intersection between healthcare and technology, and medicine and technology. And in fact, I quit medicine for a while, about 8 years into it, just quit completely and did a startup company.
Wow.
A voice-to-data technology company. And the idea was this, was, you know, I this whole chart thing is bothering me, and we're going to have to go to an electronic version at some point. So what I wanted to do was use voice recognition. I wanted to wear like a countryman, right?
Right.
While I'm examining the patient, while I'm talking, we're a countryman, and I've got voice recognition that's pulling that out, and then I've got natural language processing that I lay over top of that and automatically then populate a database. Mm. And I tried to simplify it enough. We were working with a Belgian company, tried to simplify it enough so that the natural language processing would work, so it was, you dictate into a template.
Early Dragon.
Right. I mean, the fact is the technology wasn't there yet, so it didn't work, but I envisioned someday having to do this,
right.
And I wasn't really that thrilled about it. So, you know, that was my first foray into technology and healthcare. Learned a lot of valuable lessons there. But then, when I went back into practice, I actually went to work for the guy that I'd sold my practice to. After that didn't work out.
Wait, let me ask a question. Because I dabbled in leaving medicine right after residency. I spent a year working for two startups in a similar phenomenon. But, you know, for me, I acutely felt the lack of connection and purpose. And something happened where then when the job came up to be a hospitalist at Stanford, I took it eagerly and fell in love. I realized what I was missing, which is this.
Yeah.
And the team dynamic and all those things. So what drew you back? Was it just I need a job, or was it something different?
Yeah, I think that there's nothing that and what's the old song? Don't it always seem to go? You don't know what you got till it's gone.
It's gone.
And being a physician was so much a part of my identity, and it was that connection. That's the piece that I really missed. And I realized that I could go out and raise money, and then I could, you know, do all of these things that were different, and I could make money doing that. But I missed that piece of it, that piece of connection, and that piece of having like real meaning and purpose to my life. And I'm not suggesting that you know, that's the only way to do that.
Right.
It just, for me, was so foundational that that I went back to it. And again, working for the guy I'd sold the practice to. And interestingly enough, at that point, I said, look, I don't want anything to do with administration.
Right.
I don't want an administrator talking to me. I don't want to hear from an insurance company. I want to show up. I want to do my job. I want to take care of my patients. And I want to go home.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And I did that for a few years. Mm. And then I was asked to come evaluate something called EICU.
Like a tele-ICU type of thing.
Tele-ICU. And actually, it was my partner who I'd sold the practice to that I was working for now. He said, hey, Robert, I know you like this tech stuff. Do you want to go evaluate this in Chicago? Banner, who existed by then. Actually, I worked at a hospital that pre-existed Banner but became part of that family. And he said, you want to go evaluate it as the, you know, the local yokel to go look at this technology. And in that process, I met Deb Dahl, who is our Banner's vice president for innovation. And we hit it off. From the get-go, and the next thing you know, I'm applying to be the guy that rolls out EICU for Banner Health.
So that's how it happens.
Yeah, yeah.
You get kind of sucked in like that. And
yeah.
It's interesting, so for the younger docs out there who are like, how do I get involved in the innovation side and the administration side while still doing clinical medicine, this is one kind of path. You just end up connecting with a piece and then you pursue it.
Totally unplanned.
Unplanned. Yeah. Did you have mentors in this, or were you the mentor?
For EICU?
Yeah, just for this whole process.
God, yes. I mean, for the process, I would call it stumbling around and falling into things with great fortune.
I know
actually.
That feeling.
For the EICU, oh yeah. I mean, I got to know the two founders really well, Brian Rosenfeld and his partner. It
Another
would come
guy.
To me, yeah.
Yeah.
No, and really great guys and very smart guys. Mm. I got to know them really well. And I got to tell you, my experience at failure prior to that served me well when I went in to roll out this technology because, you know, surprisingly, there was a lot of resistance to having a camera in the ICU and, the ability for others to listen in and see what you're doing.
Right. Might keep us safer as practitioners, though, from violent family members and things like that, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The only people who really had a problem with it, though, other than the doctors and the nurses,
who were pushing back,
the patients didn't have a problem with it at all, except for the schizophrenics who felt like somebody was watching them.
Which they were.
Yeah.
Right. So
this time they were right.
So the idea is remote monitoring with cameras, biometrics, and someone outside is monitoring, or how did this work in the ICU?
Yeah, so there's a location, call it a bunker, call it the clinical operations room. It's been called lots of things, but it's a location usually off campus, because if it's on campus, doctors can't help themselves. If something's happening, they'll run away, and leave everybody else stranded because this patient needs me right now.
Right.
And so it's usually off campus, and there's a crew of board certified intensivists, critical care nurses, and administrative support, if you will. And they are constantly monitoring every ICU bed in Banner Health, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there's an algorithm, a computer algorithm, that's constantly running, looking for adverse trends, which computers are much better at than doctors who are poking their head in every now and then. So I like to say we did four things. One is immediately respond to requests for help.
Right.
And you can be there virtually instantaneously.
Right.
We dotted the I's and crossed the T's, whether it's DVT prophylaxis, stress ulcer prophylaxis, whatever the...
So all the algorithms you were able to get.
All the stuff that we should be doing, but
checklist,
it's easy to forget.
Right.
Yeah. The third thing that we did was identify adverse trends and try to interrupt before they become adverse outcomes. And then the fourth thing that we always want to do is measure what we're doing so we can continuously get better.
Right. So sepsis, things like that, you might catch
Yes.
Early. You'll see a little tachycardia, low-grade temperature, other signs of sepsis.
Yep.
Got it. Well, that's interesting. So, and as a pulmonary critical care doctor, that was obviously clearly a fit, so it wasn't a big stretch for you. But when did things start to become a stretch when you started shifting into more administrative leadership roles, or was this a more of a natural fit? So at Banner, say, you know, if you have a chief medical officer role as a part of Banner, or ultimately what you're doing now, which is a true, like, serious, I mean, when we're going to talk about that. Because is where we're getting into real health systems transformation that could ripple out in a really meaningful way. Was it hard for you to switch into that, or was this part of just who you are in your training?
You know, it evolved. I remember clearly when I was interviewing at Banner, and John Hensing, who is my former boss, the chief medical officer for the big Banner, was at that interview. And I remember saying, I like to build things.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily keen on running them.
Right. I feel that way.
Built, but I like to build things.
Yeah.
And one of the interviewers said, well, that's not what we're looking for.
Right.
And Dr. Hensing, to his credit, piped up and said, no, I think that's exactly what we're looking for. And so once I did that, he kept throwing me stuff like, okay, that's great. Now we want the bedside critical care teams shored up. And
yeah.
Why don't you work on that? Okay, that's great. How about reliability, clinical performance across all specialties? Can you work on that for me for a while? So we kept throwing, and so it just incrementally added up, and I kept doing more and more things
right.
Within Banner Health, and pretty soon you got a career. You
know? Now, it seems to me like a lot of the stuff you were doing, first of all, I'm a big proponent of, and I'm sure you are as well, clinician leadership.
Yep.
So it has to be us, doctors, nurses, et cetera, people who touch patients, who have clinical experience that lead
Absolutely.
Transformation.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, what are you leading? So a lot of the stuff you just mentioned sounds to me like the typical health 2.0 catchphrases. Reliability, and are you doing a Gemba walk, and is there lean, and it was Six Sigma, and this and that. And what's your take on these sort of adages of the 2.0 sort of process improvement stuff?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, because let's take EMR as an example.
Mm. So do we have to?
What's that? Yeah, well, it's a great one, you know, because it sucks.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have to use it on a regular basis, it's painful. And the analogy is this. It's as if we're back in, you know, cars when they were first invented, right? Mm. You got to go out. You got to crank the darn thing by hand. It sputters. It's unreliable. You know, the ruts in the road, you feel every single one of them, it runs out of gas, and it's easier just to ride a horse.
Right.
But somebody had the vision that one day
it's going to be better.
There's going to be a highway,
yeah.
And there's going to be, you know, interchanges, and there are going to be possibilities and beyond possibilities. And so the other analogy that I like to use is, what is reliability? I mean, it's really, and Brent James has said this before, but if you got a choice, and this will anger everybody.
Good.
I like that. If you got a choice between doing things the right way and doing them the same way, do them the same way.
Yeah.
Now, that's interesting.
Interesting.
Now, what he means by that is until you are doing them the same way, you don't even have a baseline
to know what's
which
right.
to compare.
Yeah.
So reliability is simply, let's establish how we do something so that we can get better at it.
Right. Now, you know, the pushback will be, well, now you're talking about cookbook medicine, you're talking about a one-size-fits-all solution. Is that true? Or are you saying, no, there are certain standard practices that you standardize, then you can compare, and then you can keep improving?
Yeah, okay, so when I present that, what I say is this. There are certain things that we all agree should happen. Let's make that part of the system.
Hmm.
Let's make that reliable, because we all agree it should happen.
Colon cancer screening.
Whatever it is.
Or whatever it is.
Whatever
yeah.
it is. Evidence-based medicine.
Right.
Let's make sure that the system takes care of that stuff. I'm actually elevating professionalism because what I need you for, dear doctor, is to be looking at patterns and creating relationships with the patient and influencing their behavior and their decisions. And, you know, I'd like you to be awake and alert to do that tomorrow. So let the system take care of this rote stuff that drives you nuts anyway. And here's the, let me give you this example. When you got up this morning, and you decided you wanted to go somewhere in your car, did you say to yourself, gosh, I have absolute autonomy. I will drive as fast as I want on whatever side of the road I wish to, because I am Z-Dog.
Oh, well, that's pretty much how I roll. I don't know about you, Tom Heineberg, but that's how I roll.
But no, I mean, you gave up some autonomy.
Yeah.
So that all of us can get someplace safely,
and quickly.
Efficiently, and quickly, and reliably.
Mm.
That's all we're talking about. I don't want to usurp independent judgment. What I want to do is make the stuff that we all agree should happen, happen. Now, that changes the role of the physician, because now we're asking them a lot to check the box, remember,
right,
remember.
Right.
Now we're saying, hey, you need to identify those situations where doing this would be the wrong thing to do.
Right.
Because if you don't, it's going to happen automatically.
Right. So you're saying, okay, standardize everything you can standardize, automate what can be automated, but rely on physicians and clinicians and nurses and people with clinical judgment to say, no, but our role is to make sure those things happen, but to also recognize when they shouldn't happen.
Bingo.
So that patient where you really shouldn't be doing that PSA or you shouldn't be doing something because you're going to cause harm in that specific patient because you have the time, the space,
Bingo.
And the incentive to actually know that unique patient. Now, here's the thing. So a lot of people will push back, Robert, and they'll say, but okay, in a big banner health where I get tons of messages every day. A lot of them, if I go and talk about Banner Health, people will say, I work at Banner, they're terrible. This nurse staffing ratios are horrible. It's a big, massive enterprise, and they treat everybody like a number. And then some people will say, it's great, they support us, they give us teamwork. How do you deal, again, as a leader? I know you, Robert, you're trying to do the right thing to make everything better, and you have the experience of 1.0 under your belt. You're not an MBA who's saying, I went to Harvard and I learned these different processes and we're going to apply them here. Yeah. And it's going to be just like, you know, Office Space or whatever, and we're going to get the Bobs to consult and we're going to lean it down. That's not you. But how do you sort of reconcile all these disparate entities trying to push different ways? Because I'll tell you, my tribe, if I read comments right now, I bet you there'd be people who'd be like, screw this, they're throwing out angry faces, although usually that's our vegan trolls. We have a series of vegan trolls and anti-vaxxers who just like to hit the hands. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, you know, it's a challenge. I mean, it really is. I mean, and to be perfectly transparent about this, I don't know everything. I don't know all the answers. But when I have these conversations with the people that I am engaged with and the people that I connect with, we can come to an understanding. I mean, and we do get to the point where they go, okay, I kind of get that. Let's try that for a while and let's see. And sometimes I push too far. And sometimes they're not willing to go far enough. But but through that dialogue, and it all boils down to the same thing. We were joking earlier about maybe having some Tina Turner, What's Love Got to Do with It? But bottom line, relationships with my team, whether they're peers, superiors, or somebody that's reporting to me for a time or for whatever, patients, it's all the same thing. If you have the connection and you build the trust and you build the relationship, you can come to consensus on how to move forward. That's really what it boils down to.
Now, so this really has to do with leadership and trying to transform a system from 1.0 to 2.0. Now we're talking about taking that leap from 2.0 where you're talking about process improvement, reliability, sort of automating what can be automated, fixing the EHR to turn it from a Model T to a Tesla, that kind of thing, right? How then do we make that leap from the 2.0 to the 3.0? And that's where I want to talk about this Banner Aetna thing. People ask me, why are you, because I'll occasionally go and speak for internal meetings with Aetna.
Yes.
And trying to show them my version of 3.0. Now, why would they even care? They're a massive insurance company. And the answer is their leadership, Karen Lynch, Mark Bertolini, they actually get this.
This is fascinating to me.
It is. Yeah, and before we get into that, Tom, are there any comments you want to read or anything you want to interrupt us
with? Well, Kim actually wants a more specific explanation for what Banner actually is.
Mm. Ah, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, good idea.
Banner Health is actually, it's a merger of two health systems in right around 1999, 2000. That is mostly in Phoenix, Arizona, so some 28 hospitals now. I think I'll get this right. I'll try. 28 hospitals, there are 40-something urgent care centers, 2,000 employed docs, and other stuff. The University of Arizona health assets are owned by Banner.
So
two academic medical centers, two medical school affiliations, both in Arizona, in Tucson, and in Phoenix. About a $7 billion enterprise now.
Wow.
That's Banner Health. Now, Banner Health Network, which I was working with, was the, we'll use some more 2.0 jargon, the value-based arm of that system. So it not only included all of that, but another 6,000 independent practitioners, which in Arizona, onesies and twosies are a big part of that.
So these are just autonomous physicians.
These are autonomous physicians that were trying to say, hey, can we all work together to drive some better outcomes, number one, and certainly we're trying to bend the cost curve because there's so much waste in medicine,
right?
And also try and improve the way that we take care of people. I mean, healthcare is broken. It's expensive. It's unreliable. The service is poor. We hurt people.
All the time. Yeah.
It's broken.
Yeah.
And it's our responsibility as clinicians to fix it. And so that's what drives me. That's what I'm trying to do. No matter what it is, that's where I'm trying to get.
And this is where, so the coming together of a big network like this, the Banner Network, I imagine part of it is to be able to negotiate with insurance companies, part of it is to have leverage, part of it is to have economies of scale, part of it is to share IT infrastructure and best practices and those kind of things.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, and you know, this is happening around the country, this consolidation.
Yep.
The question is, how can this be a good thing? So if we're now going to launch, if we're going to talk about this thing with Aetna, which to me, when I saw this, at first I was like, oh dear God, no, the Borg are taking over the Borg. Like, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And then I learned more about it, and I met the people leading it, and I talked to the doctors there, and I talked to you, and I learned more. Teach us about this thing.
Let me just say a little bit about where that came from. What caught my attention was I heard Bertolini talking.
He's the CEO of Aetna.
CEO of Aetna with the CEO of Banner, a fellow named Peter Fine. And the conversation that they're having moves to, well, we both agree, right, that the tools and tactics for managing patients ought to live in the delivery system.
Yeah. Where it's actually provided.
And that's not the way it works today, right? Because, Aetna has case managers, and Aetna has utilization management, and Aetna has pre-approvals, and all of that stuff.
I'm sorry, I'm on a prior auth call, Robert. I can't talk right now.
Exactly.
Yeah, so
exactly.
All of that stuff
should be either eliminated or pushed to the delivery system. And I went, wow. That's the first time I've heard that from an insurer. Here's an insurance company that's trying to, essentially, in the long term, eliminate insurance. I mean, that's really, when you listen to Bertolini in detail, that's what he's talking about. He's saying, we got it backwards. We got it upside down. We should be, instead, getting information on, what's the gap? And what's the problem that we need to solve here? A lot of it is social, but what is the problem that we need to solve? Then we can go back and talk about how we finance that instead of saying, we got this one size fits all, here are your benefits, and go for it.
Well, this is oddly like what we say. We always say here on the show, let's stop arguing about who's going to pay for what and what. We should be fixing the delivery of this in a way that makes it efficient, collaborative, outcomes-based, unique and personalized for the patient, but also with an eye to populations, which means exactly what you said. Push this crap that's currently insurance companies telling doctors how to practice, which is how we see it, and put it back with us.
Give it to the doctors.
Right. And how do you think this Banner Aetna sort of joint venture might do that?
Well, for example, Aetna is delegating a lot of pharmacy functions. That's unheard of. No insurance company does that. They're delegating prior authorization. That's going to be
a
delivery system function. Correct.
Wow.
Insurance companies just don't do that. So they're
isn't that the fox guarding the hen house? If the doctors are the ones spending the money, doing the tests, ordering the stuff, ordering the meds, if they're the ones also doing the utilization.
Now remember, this is not fee for service.
This is the secret sauce.
Yeah, how do we bend the cost curve? And we decide what the metrics are, but if you meet this is a different model. It's not just piecework anymore. This is about value-based care. Is it pure capitation? No, but it's approaching that.
Just so you guys understand, Zipak, what Robert is saying is, and we've talked about this on the show, in a fee-for-service world where we bill an insurance company for every widget that we do, we're going to do a lot of widgets. It's just the nature of the context that we work in. We will think it's okay to cath someone with gastroesophageal reflux disease, and it will feel right to our elephant because our livelihood depends on it. And we talked about this with Robert Pearl and others on the show. Now, the question that can happen is you have an insurance company and a bunch of doctors and nurses and clinicians. They're normally antagonistic because of that fee-for-service relationship. Now, what happens when you change it to you get money to keep people well? And capitation is just a flat fee per patient per month to keep people well, but there's other ways to skin that. You could pay by actual measured outcomes, you can do different things, cost sharing, et cetera. All that being said, if that's the case, you can then tell the insurance company here is saying, Robert, we trust you guys. You're smart clinicians. You'll do the right thing if you know that you're getting paid to do the right thing, not to do more things.
Yep.
And then they shift that function to you guys. So no longer is an insurance company telling you how to practice medicine, right?
But that's correct.
But what are they giving you?
Well, they have resources.
Ah.
I don't know if you've noticed.
I've noticed they have resources.
But they have resources that, you know, this simply size, for one thing, I mean, is phenomenal. They're 10 times the, 8 to 10 times the size of Banner, for example.
Yeah.
And so having a partner like that, and to some extent, I actually believe that there's a significant segment of Aetna that gets this. Their culture suggests to me that they get this and that they really want to do something that changes healthcare. Could I be fooling myself? I hope not. But my sense tells me that there is opportunity here to move the ball. And we've tried so many things. And I won't sit here and tell you I know exactly what's going to get us to the point where this really takes off. But I think this sort of integration where you take the payer and you say no longer are you incentivized to scalp the docs.
Right.
And you take the delivery system and say no longer are you incentivized to jack up your prices to get the maximum you can from the insurance rates. You guys are in this game together. Figure it out. And my experience tells me, you know, EICU, but my experience going, I've documented it with EICU, cost quality, two sides of the same coin. If you dramatically improve quality,
Cost goes down.
Yeah,
exactly.
It goes down.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, we dropped the mortality rate in our intensive care units in Banner to, you know, 60% of Apache predicted, while at the same time, length of stay went down to 70% of Apache predicted. And that's hospital plus ICU length of stay. So dramatic improvement in cost, dramatic improvement in quality. This is possible to do across the board.
So let me ask you, because one of the things I would anticipate, and having been to a couple of these conferences now, here's the thing, Robert. Like, look, I'm a skeptical, and I'm responsible to my constituents, which are the ZPAC, to not, first of all, deceive them, and to try to shine a light on things that could work, but also be honest about when they're not working or what the dangers are.
Yeah.
Now, I was very skeptical about the Aetna thing. Then I went and spoke at the conference you were at.
Mm-hmm.
And saw the engagement with the message I was giving, which is the same message I give the ZPAC.
Yeah.
I met you.
It's a tough message.
It's a tough message to hear, and especially for older docs and for insurance people.
Yep.
So then I did it again for a group of Aetna leaders, and I got a standing ovation.
Wow.
From an insurance company's leaders, and I was giving the same message that I tell the ZPAC, that I did in my TED talk, then I did it again the other day in Phoenix, and the same response. And it makes me think that there's something about this group of people, their leadership, the partnerships, that puts them in a potential to actually make transformative change, even though they are part of the legacy system that could be considered the problem.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I just think that, you mentioned the legacy, and the natural history of legacy systems is that
they don't do
they
well.
Disappear.
They don't do well.
Yeah, they don't do well. And but I think what's really interesting about Aetna's leadership in particular is if you really listen to what Bertolini is saying, he's saying, and he's not just saying it, he's doing something about it, his compact with employees. I mean, Aetna basically unilaterally, didn't have to do it, but unilaterally said, you know what, we've got folks that we employ that are suffering, that can't afford their lives. And so he unilaterally said, okay, the minimum we'll pay anybody now is $16 an hour. And that impacted thousands of Aetna employees that, he didn't have to. And then he said, oh, and by the way, if you're under 300% of the poverty level, you have zero health care expenses anymore with Aetna.
Oh,
And he's turning it upside down. They pay you to sleep.
I like that.
Yeah, I mean, they pay their employees to sleep, which is really cool. And you know, what does that mean? Well, it means that once a year, you can take a little device home, and if you get exactly or more 7.5 hours of sleep for 20 days straight, they give you money. Isn't that crazy?
That's the kind of invasive metrics that I actually would like. You know, pay me to sleep. Yeah,
it's novel though, and it's. Bertolini, I think, understands that we have neglected our responsibility for social determinants of health support. And because of that, we're suffering.
Well, so Bradley James Olson says, I hear all these words, but I do not see any actions towards Health 3.0.
Yeah. You know what? It is like walking in mud. It really is. My biggest fear with Banner Aetna is that Banner plus Aetna equals bureaucracy squared.
Squared, right.
I mean, it's not. And let me say that for a company that is used to making pretty good money, doing it the old-fashioned 2.0
way. The 1.0 way.
Yeah. 90% of their income comes from that.
Right.
Cannibalizing yourself doesn't sound all that attractive for a company like Aetna that has, done really well in the insurance business. Eliminating yourself doesn't sound all that attractive. So it's not that this is, gosh, we're going to snap our fingers and instantly this will happen. But I saw, at least I saw potential that there is enough top leadership that are pointed in the right direction. That doesn't mean everybody is pointed in the right direction.
Right.
But there's enough of that top leadership pointed in the right direction that we got a shot at this. I think who's going to transform the system, it's going to be one of three things. It's going to be either a very well-run doctor-led organization that doesn't have these big expensive buildings called hospitals to worry about.
Right, yeah.
It's going to be one of the horsemen, Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook.
The horsemen of the apocalypse.
Yeah, well, it was Scott, what's his name? Scott Galloway's book, fascinating waltz through all of the DNA in those organizations. Or it's going to be a tightly integrated organization of sufficient scale to get people's attention. It's not going to be, in my opinion, United plus Optum, although that's the real behemoth in the market.
Yeah, they are huge.
That's a $200 billion organization.
Yeah.
And Banner is seven.
I'll say this. My experience, and again, and I'm going to address the ZPAC on this one because I feel like here we have a platform, we have a voice to be able to speak truth to power and say, look, guys, like we on the front lines feel this way, and if you try to screw us, we will cut you. And I think one of the things that I've noticed with the little bit of work that I've connected with Aetna is that they are actually motivated to do this. Now, I have also worked with others in this space, and you mentioned one of them. I won't say it again because it's a bad word, but I've worked with them in the turntable context. I work with them in other contexts. They say all these things and they do the opposite. And part of the reason is they're so big that their internal processes compete with each other for dominance. If something comes up that's truly disruptive, another division will smack it down.
Yeah.
And then everyone in that division that's leading gets fired.
Yeah.
That is the kind of corporate bureaucratic evil that we have to strive against.
And that's a really important point because one of the things that I advocated and fought for pretty hard at Banner Health Network, the insurance division,
right,
is different from Big Banner, which is the hospitals, the docs, the employed docs, the urgent care centers, that whole, all of those little pieces of the delivery system. Banner Health Network includes all the independents, number one, but it also is trying to do something very different. And so for the first 4 or 5 years, BHN is borrowing corporate services. So we'll borrow some case management services. We'll borrow some quality services. We'll borrow some leadership. I don't think that works because at the margin, Big Banner is going to lean towards, the momentum, which is fee for service, do it this way. You know, we need, heads and beds.
Yeah, heads and beds, volume.
Mantra.
Yeah.
And so I advocated for, we really need to pull case management over into BHN so that it's semi-autonomous. And we got that accomplished. And you know what? We need a quality team that's unique to BHN because quality is very different in our world than it is in yours.
Right.
And we're getting that done now. So I think the same thing, and I don't know whether it's going to come to pass yet or not. I've been in this role for a month.
Yeah.
So I don't have all the answers, nor do I know all the context yet. But I feel the same way about this. If it's going to be just a little experiment here, but we'll trickle some resources your way every once in a while, probably won't work. We have to have enough resources to try and fail. We have to have enough autonomy to actually compete with our parent companies, right? I mean, that's the real story. And it's not just about competing side by side. It's like, I'd like to cannibalize you.
Right.
You know, and that's not easy.
We want you to disappear. Yeah, exactly. Well, but you know what? That's the only way it's going to work, because you and I both know that the path we're on currently with our legacy systems is a path to ruin.
Yes, it is.
And we've said that we have gone to war as a country for less than this system has done to us as a people. Yeah. It has let us down. We have medical errors. We have too much cost. We do things to people instead of for them. A lot of what we do is unnecessary, misguided, not evidence-based, and we have to do something about it.
And we have sucked up every bit of increased productivity of the middle class for the last 2 decades.
For 2 decades.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine where we'd be as a country if healthcare wasn't the weight dragging us back. Yeah. And the truth is, you and I have both profited from this.
Yes,
because
true.
We've practiced in the 1.0, 2.0 systems. And so we have to come to peace with that and then try to push through and build something different. And that's a challenge. When your livelihood depends on believing the truths of a system, you will not look for new truths.
Yes.
You will resist change. Mm-hmm. And that's why sometimes you have to force yourself to have your livelihood depend on different truths. And that's what you've done. I had to do that when I quit and moved out here. It's the same thing.
You gotta take some risk and put it out there in order to really move into that space. I agree with you.
Tom, comments?
Speaking of, you know, sort of making peace with that, Dr. Robert, me and you were talking earlier before the show about meditation. Mm. How has that sort of helped you on this whole journey? Because Z, you're a frequent meditator too. Does it help you as well?
It helps me a lot. But Robert, when I talked to Robert about it the other time we were at a meeting, my jaw dropped with Robert's actual meditative experience, which is extensive, and I wanted to learn from him. And I want to do it now because we haven't had a chance to really talk about it. And again, this is a little shift, but it's not really, because we're talking about transcending as a system to a 3.0. First, you have to personally transcend the sort of conditioning, the self, all these other things that have kind of accumulated as baggage over the years.
Yeah.
And, you know, they say, you know, medicine changes one funeral or retirement at a time. It doesn't have to. It can change one enlightenment at a time.
Yeah. And I guess the way I got into it was probably what you call burnout.
I'm not familiar with that. Yeah.
And I just, you know, I needed a way to step off the merry-go-round at least for a little while and recollect. There's a phrase that my wife's family uses about remember yourself. And which is interesting since there isn't one, but
right, the self is an illusion, right? Yeah,
but it is a useful phrase for me, and I think about that a lot when I'm getting frenetic or out of, and the practice of meditation has made it possible for me to create a little bit of space. Most of the time, you know, I suck at it like everybody else does, but most of the time between stimulus and reaction.
Ah.
And if I have that little bit of space, then I can prevent causing myself a whole lot of trouble.
So, Zipak, we've talked about the elephant's unconscious response that's conditioned. You get a stimulus and the elephant goes, "Bah!" And the writer, who's aware of that response and then justifies it as a press secretary. I think what Robert's saying is, and I've experienced this with meditation you can actually be aware of the conditioned response and put a space between it and what you actually do. Brené Brown calls it the shitty first draft. Like, the first time you write an email about something, it's really bad.
It's perfect, yeah.
And then you go look back at it the next day and you change it, and it's that second draft that's insightful, that's more thoughtful, and that actually gets outcomes.
Yeah.
And the problem is, more often than not, as monkey mind, we just hit send on our first draft.
Yeah.
And so meditation is a space.
It is, it is. And you know, the practice part of it, I just... And by the way, when I first went into meditation, I wanted it to solve all my problems.
Yeah.
It won't do that.
It doesn't do that, yeah.
It won't solve your problems. It won't make you more religious. It won't make you a better person, frankly. I discovered that anyway.
You're a horrible person. Yeah. I mean, it's made you worse.
And so I got frustrated with it for a while and said, you know, screw this. I wanted a fix. I want something to fix me. But then I went back to it and had some great experiences with, you know, long meditation retreats. And if you can get past that barrier of, I can't meditate, I suck at this, I'll never be any good at this, I can't stop thinking, it doesn't help me. I mean, how many excuses I came up with, a million of them.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of the excuses now, every day I get up and for 25, 30 minutes, depending on the day, I sit there.
Mm.
I mean, it's really almost that simple.
Mm.
And let everything else fall away. Don't, you know, if I, you know, I get a thought about, you know, oh my God, I got to, I mean, fine. Just let that thought go. It'll be there later. Trust me.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere. Yeah.
It's not going anywhere. And at some point in that process, I began to realize that, you know, this is okay. Mm. All of this stuff is okay. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about the paradox of the reality, for me anyway, that I feel like I live in is, you know, it's that Star Wars bar, and I don't know if everybody's a Star Wars fan, but it's just, you know, this nasty glop gooks flying everywhere. That's life, right?
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. That's, you know, down to the nitty gritty. And then there's Major Tom, who's out here just softly floating, you know.
In the vacuum of space.
In the vacuum of space.
Yeah.
And it's being able to find Major Tom in the middle of the Star Wars bar that makes the difference. And they are both simultaneously true.
Present.
I mean, that's really the way that I experience it anyway.
How important was the retreat to your progression as a meditator? I mean, these are silent retreats for how many days, like a week?
Yeah, I mean, they vary depending on what tradition or whatever. But the one that I went to, you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you start meditating at 5, and you do it for 25 minutes, and then you walk for 5 minutes. 25 minutes, you walk for 5 minutes. During the day, you have an hour and a half silent breakfast that's formalized.
Mm.
You have an hour and a half lunch, and then you have an hour and a half for dinner, and you go till 9 o'clock, and then you go to bed, and you get up and do it again.
Mm.
And that's for usually a week. And people think, gosh, what a waste of time. But it's not. I mean, getting to know myself in that way, there's just no substitute for it. And coming back after a retreat like that.
What's that like?
I'm here to tell you, man, the world is crazy. It is insane. You know, I pulling up, you know, first of all, starting my car, I thought it was going to blow up. It's like, where did all that noise come from?
Wow.
And it's just the stimulation that we're exposed to on a regular basis. It's a wonder that any of us are still sane. And now with the, you know, the short attention span theater, and, you know, I was watching the TV the other day, the camera never rests.
Yeah.
And it's gotten worse as time has gone on, it seems, and the complexity, et cetera. And having that place to just be calm and relaxed and not chase any thoughts or, I mean, it's just so cool.
So I'm looking to do it. And I'm going to live stream the whole damn thing, Tom Heineberg. I'm going to be live tweeting because it's silent, but doesn't mean I can't tweet.
That's true.
And I'm going to be like, oh my God, I'm so calm, you guys. I'm so calm right now. You can't even believe it. Oh, this is so blissful. Anyways. But see, that I think that's how our minds work now. We're constantly reaching for our phone. We're constantly, like you said, the cuts are very quick. Wait till you see the video. I think I played it for you, the video we're going to release tomorrow with the animojis.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So Tom, other comments?
Let's see.
Anything you want to tell these guys, like any words of wisdom, any, I think, they really want, again, I think most of us want to feel like 3.0 is going to happen.
Yeah.
In an organic, real way. And there's a lot of skepticism because we've been burned too many times.
Yeah. I have a good comment from Jen who says, honestly, I listened to AMA or Incident Report on the way home from work as a deterrent to burnout. I listen and feel encouraged because I know there's a huge community out there pulling to make medicine better. So I think like having you on, Dr. Robert, and having the conversation with so many people, it is starting to change, but we're not necessarily seeing the action quite yet, so.
Yeah, you know, and it's, gosh, I was reading somebody the other day who said, it almost is gonna take a movement.
Yeah.
Like civil rights.
Yeah.
It's health rights.
Dave Chase has been saying this, and he said it's kind of like a Rosie the Riveter, like this the woman who in World War II was a symbol of stay at home and build the war machine at home.
Yeah.
We need that in healthcare.
We do. We do. We really need something to rally around. And I think it's ZDOG.
Well, I'm not going to take credit for it, but I think we have a studio audience here. Hey, you guys, come over here for a second. You want to say hi to the ZPAC? So part of the thing is, if you're a donor on Patreon, what up, fam? You can come and be in our studio audience. And we've got two nurses here from Idaho. What were your names again?
Blake and Madison.
Blake and Madison. And they came all the way to Vegas to do a thing, and they are part of the movement. If we can't start a grassroots movement between docs, nurses, and muggles like Tom and Logan, I don't know who can do it. So it's on us, people. You know what I'm saying? Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Oh, hell yeah, president. I don't want to be president. That sounds horrible.
Yeah.
Although you can be my press secretary because you're good. Real good. I was going to say, so a couple things I wanted to answer here. Lisa Yoakum says, I tried meditation and I fell asleep. Sue Lewis also says, I fall asleep when I meditate too. Listen, guys, that's not uncommon.
No, it's not.
And actually, the Buddhists have a whole algorithm for this. The Buddhists were the first checklist 2.0 sort of way, because it's called, there's subtle dullness. And there's gross dullness, and there's different kinds of tiredness, and actually appreciating the type of tiredness you're feeling, and then eventually overcoming it.
Well, and the bottom line is, that's okay.
Yeah, it's part of
it's
the
all
process.
Okay.
It's
and part you of might fall asleep for 4 years trying to meditate, but that's okay.
That's okay.
And you know, some of the time it's maybe a need to work for Aetna, and they can pay you to get some sleep.
You need something to push a little bit.
Well, and that's the real answer is that's okay.
Right.
Whatever it is, it's okay. You just go back and you do it again.
So my meditation this morning, I use something called Insight Timer. Do you use it?
I use that.
Yeah, I love it. It's great. And it'll just be like, bong!
Yeah.
And it'll play a gong, and then you can set how long you want it and how often it'll play the bells. So I do a 30-minute meditation, and the bells ring at 15 minutes and 30 minutes. And the minute I'm so conditioned now because it...
Wow, we are so close on this.
Isn't that scary? So I'm so conditioned because I've done it enough now that my unconscious knows when it hears that bell, it goes right into...
It is a trigger.
Yeah. A trigger. It goes into meditation mode. I focus on the breath. Then those wandering thoughts arise and I'll see them and I'll go, oh, tonight Dr. Groves is going to be on the show. Maybe I'll ask him about this and this. Yeah. Oh, wait, the breath. Back to the breath. And then, oh, you know, Tom and I are supposed to do an emoji thing. Oh, you know, the Tom and this and his beard. And oh, my God, I hope he didn't have Chipotle for lunch. Oh, the breath. And it comes back. And it's that repeated sort of conditioning. Then about 15 minutes when that second bell rang, I was in a blissful, you know, that bliss that arises?
Oh, yeah.
So this is one thing, Z-Pak.
Oh, yeah.
Here's a motivator for you. You're not supposed to chase the bliss in meditation, but when it arises, it's a full body well-being and tranquility that you can't describe. But it's so beautiful, you understand how people could become deeply religious or deeply spiritual, because you feel that and you go, oh my gosh. And that will arise.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You don't want to chase it, but when it arises, you go, okay, all right.
You don't want to be a monk.
You don't, I mean...
There will be a good 30 seconds there when you'll want to be a monk.
I know. Yeah. I've been there.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to quit all this.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell Tom Heineberg, here's my wallet. You take it. Go crazy.
Yep. Hell yeah.
I'm going to go.
Hell yeah.
I'm going to go to a cave. Mm-hmm. I'm going to call my boy Robert Groves. I'm going to be like, we're going to a cave, Robbie. Let's do this.
Oh, my.
And that might happen.
Tempting.
It is tempting. Yeah. Tom Heineberg, what do you think? Should we wrap this up?
I say let's wrap it up. By the way, that happened to the Buddha. He was a real piece of shit and he left his family, so.
You know
I'm
what?
Just saying.
He did give up his material possessions.
Material things, aka his wife and son, material possessions. Not a great role model.
It's a very good point. And I'm not advocating for the Buddha in particular. But he has contributed in a big way. You know, it's interesting, I think, to think about all of the people in history who have been like that, right?
Mm.
I mean, Gandhi
was
not a great guy.
Right.
But what he contributed to mankind was remarkable. So another paradox for us to try and figure out.
This is the paradox. Some of the great gurus in history were total effing assholes.
Yes.
And the reason is they transcend the self, but the self they transcend gets really powerful.
It doesn't fix you.
Yep.
That absolute power.
Yep. Because you're able, it gives you a power. The other thing, the term for that is spiritual bypass. So it's actually a term in the literature. Mm-hmm. So people who become spiritually enlightened but are still dicks, and actually their dickishness becomes more powerful because they have this attitude that, well, no, I've actually understood.
Look how great I am.
Yeah, look how great I am. So that's the danger. If you don't work on yourself, psychotherapy, therapy, actually trying to make yourself a better person, then the spiritual stuff doesn't matter.
Yep.
In fact, it makes it worse.
I'm with you.
Well, on that note, I think we've gone 3 to 4% of the way towards building 3.0 here with this discussion.
You know what? I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me on. And I look forward to working with you. I just think it's a fabulous thing that you're doing, and I want to be a part of it.
It's an honor to be in your presence. I consider yourself a mentor to me, and I'm going to try to learn as much as I can, as quickly as I can, and then destroy you with knowledge.
Now that's the man I know.
There it is. Robert, what a pleasure, man.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Z-Pack, and we out.
I'm also honored to sit next to Logan.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
What you do is amazing, I've been a fan of yours for quite a while now, sir.
Tom.
You're welcome.
You.
You're welcome.
I hate you both so much.